Hello and welcome to another episode of the IEA podcast. I'm Emily Carver. Today's podcast is a recording of the first episode of our new YouTube series, The Definite Article. You can find the full video recording on our YouTube channel. For our debut episode, I was joined by Mark Littlewood, the Director General of the IEA, to discuss his latest column for The Times. We can learn from how other countries tackled the pandemic after it has passed. We spoke about what we'll be able to learn after this crisis is over, and Mark took questions live from our YouTube audience on everything from NHS reform to global free trade. Make sure you subscribe to watch our next episode live every Monday at 6 p.m. for free on YouTube. Hope you enjoy this podcast. Hello, good evening, and welcome to the first of our new live series, The Definite Article. Thanks for joining us for our debut show. I'm Emily Carver, and this evening I'll be joined by the IEA's Director General, Mark Littlewood. The show will be live every Monday on our YouTube channel. It's your chance to hear live from our experts on the latest articles that they've written for national papers, online magazines, whichever outlets. And you get to put your questions straight to them. So before we kick things off, make sure that you click the subscribe button and the notification bell to make sure you don't miss any future videos. And don't hesitate to ask any questions. I'll try and pick up on as many as I can. So this evening we're joined by Mark Littlewood. Hi, Mark. And we'll discuss his latest bi-weekly column for The Times out today. We've also got the article up on our website temporarily, so just follow the link below in the description box if you'd like to have a read. So Mark, thanks for being our guinea pig tonight.
My pleasure, that's what they pay me the big bucks for, right?
So your article, the title is We Can Learn From How Other Countries Tackled the Pandemic After It Has Passed. Surely this is an obvious statement, right? But for those who haven't had the chance to read your article, what's the main argument you're getting at there?
Okay, well, what triggered this article, what triggered me, was Michael Gove saying on Sunday morning that the decisions about exiting the lockdown, that the government would make a balanced judgment. Now, listen, I'm quite a fan of Michael Gove. He's a very bright guy. But this got me wondering. Firstly, I was reassured that the government was going to attempt to make a balanced judgment. Had he actually said that decisions were being made on the basis of Boris Johnson rolling a set of magic dice and whatever came up would be what the government would decide that day, or if he was going to deliberately make rash judgments rather than balanced judgments, that would be a bit worrisome. But it struck me as being a truism. Of course he's going to make a balanced judgment. And the balance that he implied, or I inferred that he was talking about, was this balance between let's assume that lockdown, isolation, closing down vast amounts of the economy is saving lives, but similarly, it's obviously having a pretty catastrophic effect on the economy. One number I've seen is that £2 billion is being wiped off the British economy every day of lockdown, and that's probably getting worse. So we're going to make a balanced judgment. Well, hurrah, good for him. And I'd expect no less of an intelligent man like Michael Gove. But that raised the question for me, how are these judgments made? Because Michael Gove and the British government are not alone in attempting to make balanced judgments. We've got politicians and health authorities all across the globe attempting to make balanced judgments, and a lot of them making very different judgments. And not all of them, I would submit, can be right. Now, it is true that local circumstances are different, so it is true that what might be appropriate for Sweden or Denmark might not be appropriate for the UK, what might be appropriate for South Korea might not be appropriate for Germany. But it seems to me so many different decisions are being made that not everybody's judgment can be correct. And if you could look for a small sort of silver lining for economic nerds like me from this unfolding disaster, that small silver lining might very well be that we're going to get a colossal amount of data at the end of this. Some of it's going to be data that will, you know, chill us to the bone a bit. It will be about how many tens of thousands of people have died. But we will be able to compare different judgments with different outcomes if we go through the data carefully. You can't just hit cut, control and paste and just assume what might work in one area might work in the other. There might be all sorts of different reasons for different mortality rates. There might be all sorts of different reasons for different economies to have suffered better or worse under lockdown. So yeah, we've got to be clear of what the differences are. But I think we're going to be able to compare healthcare systems, public health authorities, the role of politicians in making judgments, as opposed mm-hmm. to the role of scientific experts in making judgments, like never before. And yeah. my hope would be that coming out of that, when we get to the sort of post-mortem and inquest phase of this whole dramatic episode, rather than us just trying to get through day to day and minimise the loss of human life and minimise the damage to our economy, there will be very, very big lessons to be learned that could, if we're open-minded enough and sensible enough, lead to very major public service reform.
Sure. We've got a question from one of our watchers, Edward Bond. He's asking you, what do you think the relationship should be between advisors and ministers?
Well, I'm pretty Maggie Thatcher on that one. I mean, advisors advise and ministers decide. What's interesting, though, in our system is not just the question of advisors versus ministers. It's when should, if at all, some of the deliberations and actions be taken completely out of the political domain. So we might as well cut to the chase. Let's look at the National Health Service and how it is organised. And it is a nationalised monopoly, top-down structure. Essentially Matt Hancock as the Secretary of State is the chief executive of, I think, the third largest employer in the world, might even be the second largest employer in the world now. And decisions on how are we going to source more gowns or gloves or ventilators are sort of taken really at the top level by a massive national central planning committee. Now, compare and contrast that with, say, the German healthcare system, about which I don't purport to be any kind of expert. If you want to read more about comparing healthcare systems, Christian Niemitz, our research department, has written a brilliant book called Universal Healthcare Without the NHS. Well, the German system's a much more competitive, insurance-based model. And it's been put to me, and I'm not leaping to any conclusions yet. You're quite right, Emily, that in the same way that Michael Gove was screaming the bleeding obvious by saying that we should have a balanced judgment, I'm screaming the bleeding obvious by saying there will be lessons to be learned, but I haven't leapt yet to any conclusions about what those lessons are. But it's been put as a hypothesis to me that because the Germans have, and are used to, a much more competitive insurance-based system, it's not as if their health minister at the top of the tree is deciding how many gowns to send to different hospitals across Germany. They have been much more adept at the testing phase mm-hmm. of this, and were able to rattle people through testing a lot faster. Not with a politician, as I understand it, setting a sort of target on a Sunday morning TV show in which I promise by the end of the month, X number of people will be tested, and then sort of his, Matt Hancock's sort of political credibility is on the line unless these number of tests are processed. Whether that's the right number or the wrong number doesn't really seem to be the driving force. Whereas in Germany, it's being done on a much more commercialized basis. Mm-hmm. So the relationship between ministers and advisors is the advisors clearly advise. Although what I think I have found interesting, I make no judgment about whether it's the right way or the wrong way to do it. Compare the British press conferences over this, daily press conferences in Britain, with the press conferences in the United States of America. And generally speaking, in Britain, whether it have been technical or scientific questions, our politicians, our prime minister, when he was well enough to conduct them himself, would throw the question to a scientist rather than attempt to answer it himself. In stark contrast to what's actually happening at the White House, where President Trump seems keener to take sort of all of the questions on his own shoulders.
If ministers and the government are honest with themselves after this crisis is over, and as you say, there have been there are lessons to take from other health systems. Do you think that this could maybe be the catalyst that we need to sort of give policymakers a kick up the arse and finally seek reform to Public Health England and to more broadly the NHS and its funding system and the way it's structured?
Well, is that possible? Those are two very different questions, I'd say, yeah. In that Public Health England, and again, I'm not. I think it's important not to leap to any conclusions until more of the data is in. But by most accounts, are not having a particularly good pandemic. I mean, their Public Health England really have one job. It has many different facets, but is to stop or be prepared for or to mitigate genuine public health questions. That's different to the health of the public. I'm talking about infectious diseases or the potential poisoning of the water supply or an outbreak of rabies or something that has implications for the entire population. And they don't seem to me to have been to the fore here. And Christopher Snowden, who writes a lot about these sort of health issues for us, has suggested that they've actually spent a good deal of their time, resources, and expertise in recent years not preparing for what we would do in the event of a pandemic hitting us from China, but instead on, you know, what the appropriate labelling is on a piece of confectionery, or whether fast food restaurants can be proximate to schools, or what should the size of a health warning be on a cigarette packet and the rest of it. Now, you might think those are very important things for an agency to do, but we may conclude that that's distracted them from the key core task. So I actually think the public health authorities, Public Health England, and also the World Health Organization are going to have some pretty serious questions to answer when this crisis has passed. As I say, at the moment, we're dealing with it day to day. The National Health Service, much more interesting one, because it is the unofficial national religion of the United Kingdom. We have got this sort of 8 o'clock every Thursday. You've got sort of, you know, you're a social pariah if you don't stand on your doorstep and applaud bravely the people who are working in the National Health Service. In fact, I was just out for a walk earlier today and there were sort of protect the NHS flags flying from people's windows. I mean, it's extraordinary. It's like walking around when a football tournament's on and you tend to see the George as long as England's
Mark, are you surprised that people have been so willing to give up their civil liberties as they have done?
This isn't so much about the civil, this is about applauding a particular
No, but it, when we applaud the NHS, is that what's making us, is that why we're so willing to give up our civil liberties? Because
no, I think those are different things, and there's an element of the NHS applause that I'm completely with. Look, I mean, all I'm trying to do, and this is what I hope I do in my article, is to distinguish between the actual medical healthcare professionals, the doctors and the nurses and the like, who, you know, deserve a round of applause. And again, from the early data, are probably taking, you know, quite substantial risks. So it's not just a question of applauding them for their expertise and care in restoring us to health. They are actually exposing themselves, we think, to measurably higher risk by being on the front line. So I hold nothing against those people at all. In fact, I readily applaud them. That's fantastic what they're doing in very difficult, trying circumstances. But I hope we have the wit to distinguish that from the healthcare system. That you need to look at the, again, in which the question I was asking about, how does Michael Gove and the government reach a balanced judgment? Are we placing our healthcare professionals in the best possible system with the best possible mechanics, decision-making processes, devolution of power, absence of red tape? For them to do their absolute best, because I've got no doubt that health doctors and nurses in Germany, Austria, Denmark, France, Belgium are, you know, trying just as desperately hard as our healthcare professionals. So it's systems that I was trying to compare, not the, you know, the diligence of the individual people working in the system. On civil liberties, I actually think we are happy and prosaic to undergo a lot of losses of freedom, as long as it's and as long as it's justified. And again, an interesting experiment, if you're being a bit sort of inhuman about it, but it's happening in real time, is Sweden is pretty much the last liberal country on earth at the moment as we speak. But their government has not imposed or enforced on anything like the level of restrictions we've imposed here in the UK. You can still go out and eat in a restaurant. You're more than entitled to turn up to your own office, even if you could feasibly work from home. You can go and have a pint down the pub. and they've been quite adamant that they're not going to make these enforcement questions. They're issuing a whole ton of advice, and the Swedish, being desperately polite and civilized people, seem to be following that advice. But they're taking an incredibly liberal approach, at least compared to the rest of Western Europe. And we're going to see whether that works or not. We will see at the end of it. It will only be one factor. You'll have to look into a whole range of others. Somebody has said to me already that social distancing in Sweden has been a social norm for decades. So they've adapted to it now is not much of an adaptation. So you'll have to try and feature all those things in. But we will see. You know, it is likely we will be able to determine in a few months' time whether the civil liberties crackdown here was worth it, or how many lives did it save compared to Sweden. We're going to have to dive deep into this data. And I'm sure a lot of people manipulate it for their own purposes. It's very important that people don't do that, even from our free market liberal perspective, because we are comparing apples with pears, but we are still comparing fruit with fruit. And so I think that on was the civil liberties clampdown worthwhile, which healthcare systems are operating the best, and on the economic side of the equation, which countries for the lowest cost would have been able to keep the maximum number of people in work and the fewest number of companies from going into liquidation. All of this is going to come out in the wash, and I think that's going to be a fascinating wash.
We've got another question from Jimi Hendrix. He says given that the business of economists is to consider trade-offs, incentives, and the effect on human behavior, should economists play more of a role in the formation of an exit strategy?
Yeah, I think that has been a problem, that you can understand that the front of mind is the saving of human life. And you can also understand, and I did say this at the start, that the sort of the easy way to look at the trade-off is economic damage against human lives. Might turn out that wasn't the trade-off, might turn out that we misjudged where to get that trade-off right, might turn out we spent billions of pounds on something that had no impact whatsoever on saving human lives, but in the imperfect data before us, we're having to make those trade-offs. But you know what? I think there's a further feature beyond that. That you can't, let's say entirely hypothetically, I'm not suggesting these are the numbers, but if we tank our economy by 25% of GDP, we will save 10,000 British lives. Let's just assume that's the trade-off. And the unenviable position that politicians are in is, do you tank the economy by 25% to save 10,000 lives? I think that the trade-off isn't that simple, because if you tank the economy to the extent that we are, there will be very serious long-term implications for health, longevity, life expectancy, general human well-being. In fact, you can't tank the economy by anything like 25% without there being those sort of effects. They'll be much less direct than coronavirus, right? You won't be able to directly trace very many cases of the economy went backwards 25% and therefore 15 years later, this person died prematurely. It'll be a lot harder to draw the chain of cause and effect, but you could be certain it will be there. In terms of exiting the lockdown there, I think it is vital to get economic experts involved, because it's not just a question of are we in lockdown or not. As we're looking to exit it, are there particular parts of the economy which are more important from an economic point of view to release early? It shouldn't only be a medical consideration. I mean, one suggestion has been that 20 to 30 year olds should return to work earliest. But that's on medical advice, as I understand it, in that 20 to 30 year olds have shown very little propensity to get seriously ill or die of the disease. Well, that's good medical grounds. But it might be, for sake of argument, that the most productive workers in the economy are between the ages of 30 and 40. Mm-hmm. And it might be the medical risk there is a little bit higher, but the economic gain of that age cohort returning to work earlier would actually be much more beneficial for GDP. So it would be wrong for us to make all of the decisions only on a medical basis. And if Michael goes to be taken at his word, and I think he should be, that it's a balanced judgment, then it's very important that economists and experts on the business end of it, not just pure economists, are able to advise, not just scientific advisors.
Yeah, and sort of on the more how the government are managing this in their sort of in their in speaking to the public, Alexander Cully has asked, do you think the number of press conferences now should be reduced to once a week unless the government has something major to announce? Is their frequency helping or hindering the management of the crisis?
That's a great question, because if you remember at the start of it, the suggestion was that they weren't doing enough. Mm-hmm. And they were the government was being sort of somewhat lackadaisical and sort of issuing a press release as and when. I actually think, to Alex's point, from the point of view of public information, my sense is that most people have had enough of this. Actually, the last time I watched the TV news was on the night that the Prime Minister was admitted to intensive care, because I could see there was an unfolding potential disaster here. You know, that his life was under serious threat. I actually think the press conferences are no longer really about informing the public. They're about feeding the media beast.
Yeah.
24-hour news means you've got a whole bunch of reporters, albeit working from home rather than hunting directly in physical packs, who have got to find things to say. And the devil makes work for idle hands. So the intention of this press conference is to give these journalists a story every day. So I think it's aimed at them more than it's aimed at the public. I mean, I'm just keeping a news app on my phone. That's the way I'm updating myself. I'm pretty sure if something dramatic happens and I haven't checked my phone, somebody will phone me and tell me. And I think the only danger from the political point of view, the politician's point of view of ending these press conferences is you would then get journalists basically just speculating amongst each other rather than them actually broadcasting something from an authoritative.
Yeah.
So it's overkill, but it might actually have that useful benefit.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have sort of been put off by the political nature of a lot of the questions coming from the journalists. I think it's irritated a lot of people. But another question, a broader question, more to do with international relations and free trade. Some people say that we have an over-dependency on China. Should the UK deem certain industries as being of national strategic importance and assure we have the capability to produce the goods in the UK? And that's a question from Twitter.
Yeah, I'm a bit skeptical about this because you can understand where it's coming from.
Yeah.
And there clearly are certain matters of national, genuine, real national security, right? You don't want a foreign power to control your nuclear launch codes, for example, right? That's clearly got to be in one's hands. But I think the issue is not so much one's own self-production. You know, should the UK go back to making sure that we only eat food that we ourselves can produce, for example, or that we only use steel that we ourselves have manufactured? I think the question is the diversity of supply. So there's a, so if you were to take steel, right, and let's just assume for the sake of argument, I'm not sure I do accept this, but for the sake of argument, that steel is a strategic industry, because you can imagine some point in the future where, God help us, we have to go back to war and we have to manufacture bullets and tanks. And then, you know, the people we're buying steel from decide to put a freeze on it. I mean, you could just stockpile steel if you actually think you're going to need it in the future. But my issue would be, as long as you can actually source it from a variety of suppliers, or if you can, which probably isn't the case with steel, but might well be the case with food, you can quickly gear up to produce it yourself, perhaps in days, but in weeks, then worrying too much about the security of different products and services is going to lead you down a path to protectionism. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that you want the Chinese Communist Party to be the people who are overseeing in some way putting in some sort of military or sensitive material. So the controversy about Huawei, I can absolutely see but there's a danger once you go down this path, you start applying it to everything. You start applying it to agriculture, to cars, petrol, to all energy sources. And before you know it, you've got a siege economy. So my worry would be if it really is at the cutting edge of something hypersensitive and secure, like the military, or hugely sensitive data, okay, fine, that needs to be treated differently. But otherwise, focus on getting diversity of supply rather than homegrown supply.
Yeah, I mean, as I'm sure you've seen, that many on the socialist far left side of politics have been sharing how the actions taken under the current government are sort of, you know, socialist policies. So you've had John McDonnell, the former shadow chancellor, tweeting, "Whoever thought of free broadband, they'll be nationalising the railways next. Sorry, they already have," you know, making sort of sarky comments like that. How do we stop the left capitalising of off this?
Well, I mean, I think these are socialist policies, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the state is taking a bigger role in our lives than they have done in our lifetimes. I mean, and is spending more money per capita than it has in our lifetime. I mean, you know, forget the budget deficit. That's for the birds now. I mean, this is social. But is anyone enjoying it? That would be my question. I mean, is this what we want the new normal to be? Is it you can only leave your house for, you know, one walk a day, which will be strictly monitored by the police? The only shops that are open are supermarkets. You know, we typically run out of toilet paper. Yeah, I mean, it is socialism, but it's a short, the purpose of it is to have a short dose of socialism in order to get ourselves back to a free market economy. Did you say it was John Ashworth who was tweeting this?
No, John McDonnell was tweeting that.
I mean, maybe, I don't want to put words in his mouth, he thinks that utopia has arrived, that this is just what the British people want. That this is ideal. Well, it clearly isn't. It's absolutely grim. So my hope is that as and when we get out of this, and let's hope that's a matter of weeks, not months, people will start to value the freedoms and liberties, not just the civil liberties, the economic freedoms and liberties that they used to have, like never before. All sorts of things I took for granted. My ability to go down the pub when I want, go to a football match when I want, go out shopping when I want, buying what I want, go for a walk whenever I want. That's been stripped away, and I was taking those things for granted. This is a small, painful, and extremely unpleasant dose of state socialism, and the more temporary it is, the better.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen the private sector mobilise at an astonishing rate, haven't we, during this crisis? We've seen them move to change their business models so quickly, you know, with the production of PPE, medical equipment, transformation of their business models in the retail sector, for example. Ongoing, how do you think after this crisis, do you think this will show how vital the role of the private sector has to play? And how can we show that the market has a vital role to play in our recovery from this crisis? You know, how do we make the case for a small government after the state has grown so large? And are we pushing water uphill?
Yeah. So here's the potential danger. If you were to liken this to being in a war, I mean, there's all sorts of differences, right? Because, I mean, this is a kind of some degree a natural phenomenon. The human race is fighting this together rather than us shooting Germans and Germans shooting us. But if you were to liken it to a war in economic history terms, the problem when we came out of the Second World War was, although not rendered explicit, but was the kind of meme or the narrative that because centralized socialist state planning worked so well in defeating a common enemy, in this case, the Nazism of Adolf Hitler, let's apply that centralized state social planning to a range of other problems in the world, making sure everybody has a nice house, making sure everybody has good healthcare, making sure everybody's properly educated. If central social state planning was, you know, the means to defeat Germany in the Second World War, well, why don't we use the same tools to achieve other things for human betterment? There's a bit of a risk here, I think, with that. But, you know, given we all pulled together and beat the virus, why don't we all pull together and do something else? It's incumbent upon us. I mean, I'm sort of tired of saying this over and over again at the IEA. It is pushing water uphill. Free market solutions are counterintuitive and are unpredictable and don't involve grand plans or grand designs. They emerge. But I think that the things that we should be highlighting when we emerge from this is firstly to say that the entire purpose of all of this lockdown process and everything we're doing and the furloughing and the business loans, the point of it all is to save free market capitalism. That's the point of it.
Yeah.
The point was not to segue into the dictatorship of the proletariat for forevermore. It was to actually make sure that there is free market capitalism to go back to and to defend the infrastructure. I mean, unlike war, thank God, you know, the buildings will still be there. We're being literally bombed on a day-to-day basis. So when we get back, I think we've got to say, you know, the point was to return to this. And by and large, I think folk will be in agreement with that. I don't think there are many people who are finding lockdown a great deal of fun. It's a pretty miserable existence. And, you know, people want to go on holiday, want to go out, want to see their friends and their workmates. I mean, all credit to organisations like Zoom who have made these sort of things, you know, easier for us to actually get by and use and to keep businesses afloat and on the road. I mean, hurrah for all of the entrepreneurialism, some of it at a technical level, some of it at a much more practical level that's kept us going. But we're going to have to push water uphill again when we get back. Two things there which I'm optimistic about. Firstly, it's hard to imagine that after the amount of government money that's being spent in this period, that the solution is to spend even more next year and even more the year after. We are going to blow a coach and horses through the budget deficit and the national debt. So the idea that there's an easy to pull lever, which is just spend more money, I mean, at some point that runs out, or at least becomes harder to pull. You know, at some point you get into the situation that greases it. I'm not saying we're there yet, but, you know, that's the path you travel down if you keep running down that path. The other, which the IA is doing some work on, is to look at where regulations have been relaxed and assisted us dealing with this crisis. And there's lots of small regulations about the number of hours that a lorry driver can work in a given day or a given week, that a restaurant used to have specific planning permission in order to offer a takeaway service. That's been stripped away. I think there were specific rules about when supermarkets could take deliveries. You couldn't deliver supplies into a supermarket at the dark of night. That's been stripped away. And indeed, today it was brought to my attention, the NHS providers, that's the sort of trade association for NHS trusts, have released a report in which they highlight the shredding of red tape in the National Health Service actually helping. So I wonder if stripping away all this red tape and regulation has helped efficiency in a dark period, why would we want to go back to inefficiency in a lighter period? So I think there are some good arguments for us to use, but it is going to be pushing water uphill. But if you like, where John McDonnell's wrong, I'm making an inference what he said, is if this is socialism, well, people don't like it very much.
Well, yeah, exactly. I hope that we can take from this crisis how important the private sector is, and quite how important economic growth is, and how we all benefit from it. Just one last question before we finish up. Just on the World Health Organization, we've got another comment. I wondered what your thoughts were. What is your view on, many people are questioning international institutions at the moment. What is your view on multilateralism and the idea of international institutionalism as a form of global governance?
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually quite an internationalist. I know, although I was a Brexiteer, previously been quite fond of international institutions, and I think they can work. I think how they're configured is, and who they are answerable to, is the key point. And they're tested in exactly these sort of difficult times. The stress tests come now. So, you know, NATO as an international institution, I mean, it's composed of independent nation states, but you know, potentially that's quite an infringement on sovereignty. We're obliged to go to war to defend any other NATO member if they're attacked. That's pretty serious undertaking by one nation state to another. So I think international institutions can work, but they need to be fit for purpose, and crucially, they need to be answerable to the people. And my concern about the World Health Organization is it doesn't come under the same sort of scrutiny that, let's say, British politicians come under in the context of a British general election, or that American candidates for the upcoming US presidential election are coming under. You know, nobody really knows what it is, let alone how its president is elected, who selects it, how, what powers do they have? When do you see them on television being asked difficult questions rather than just issuing edicts and guidance? So I think if these institutions get too powerful and too far away from the people, or from accountability, then you get all sorts of inefficiencies and even corruptions in them. And I haven't yet read any sort of report that suggests the World Health Organization has handled this well. In fact, I've read quite a lot of reports to suggest it being totally disastrous, really. And in fact, the leader in this week's Spectator is a damning indictment of the way the World Health Organization has behaved. So I think that's going to need very radical reform or even to be scrapped. And the free nations of the world are going to have to think how they interact better in future, because we do need some sort of system to act as an early warning system for pandemics and to provide good advice, and decisions made in one part of the world impact decisions on the other part, you know, in other parts of the world. If America decides that airline travel needs to be stopped, well, that, you know, limits the number of flights coming into Heathrow and the rest of it. But I would build that back up from the bottom up. And I think we've got to have a very, very long, hard look at how accountable the systems are. But although I said I've read a couple of reports on the World Health Organization, and I applaud Fraser Nelson's leader in the latest edition of The Spectator, at the mainstream media level, this doesn't seem to be talked about at all. The World Health Organization is just experts. And they should be seen as a political institution who need to be held to account in the same way that our own politicians are held to account. And when organizations lose that, either by the way they're constructed or just the way they're perceived in the public eye, well, they're about as useful as a chocolate teapot.
Yeah, on that note, I think that's all we've got time for now. Yep. So thanks for coming on the show, Mark. Thank you very much for being our first guest. So that was Mark Littlewood, Director General at the Institute of Economic Affairs. Thank you for all the questions. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to like and subscribe for more content and for next week's live stream. Also, you can read Mark's article in the Times Online or on the IEA website via the link below. Thanks for tuning in and see you next week.